This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.
Welcome to Return to the Pine Trees, a selection of six short stories for radio broadcast about growing up in the North Dublin areas of Turnipin Lane, Clunshock, Old Coolock Lane, Clochran and the village of Santry. These stories take place between 1965 and 1970 and they bring to life a time in these respective areas on the outskirts of Dublin City before it all changed forever. These areas weren't on their own when the changes came. There were many other small townlands and villages all around Dublin, both north and south, overwhelmed by a quickly expanding city. Unfortunately for my particular area, Turnipin Lane, which is just past Santry heading north towards Dublin Airport, change came from all sides. The city to the south, Dublin Airport to the north, and the M50 and M1 to the east. The airport in particular, which is only a mile away from Turnipin Lane, was a huge influence on the way things would go. I bring these stories to you, the listeners of Near FM Radio, hoping they are enjoyable to listen to and also to provide you a social record of what was happening on the outskirts of North Dublin in the late 1960s and the early 1970s. Some events have been combined to create a good narrative. In some cases, I go into a lot of detail, especially on my journeys from place to place and the people I meet along the way. This is the social document side of things. Music is very important to the stories, and in particular, Gilbert O'Sullivan, our Irish-born singer and songwriter. His songs always resonated a certain innocence, which is exactly what I want to convey in my stories. I hope they will act as triggers and transport you right into the very heart of the stories. Please join me on my journeys, and I hope you will enjoy the stories for what they are, stories about youth and growing up in North Dublin. I've decided to use my own voice and added some gentle sound effects as part of this radio book project, which gives the stories a little bit of depth, especially in the narrative. The name of this story is Santry Woods, Bulrushes and Rafts. It is the fourth story in our series of six. My father was the very first person ever to bring me to Santry Woods. I was a very young child and it was autumn and we were there picking hazelnuts and walnuts before Halloween. The hazelnut trees close to the road near the Robber's Bank were bursting with clusters of nuts and as we picked them, we put them into an old pillowcase that Ma had given us. Da was a great man to crack the hazelnuts with his teeth and he knew the wood, as he called it, inside out. Because just like me, he had grown up in Turnipin Lane and had spent so much time there as a child himself. We would pick the nuts and then he would place them underneath the bottom shelf in our hot press to help them ripen with the heat and darkness. This was the infamous hot press that was situated in the corner of our small front sitting room. It had a hot water cylinder in the lower half and this hot press was a dysfunctional nightmare. It had doors at ground level that would only open 6 inches because the couch was in the way. The doors were always breaking at the hinges and made of plywood that often splintered and stuck into inquiring hands and arms. It was a homemade job and probably built by my uncle Dominic Duffy, who was very handy with the plumbing and the wood. The pillowcase full of nuts would be placed down in the bottom right at the back. As we got older, the Turnipin crew would sometimes make trips up the Santry Woods. It wasn't very far, and we could cut through Geraghty's fields and go down along the river at the far end of the field. From here we could walk underneath the main road through the bridge and step out into the woods with the little old red cottage where Jack Roberts used to live to our right. After that, we walked a further 50 feet over to the edge of the lake. This route guaranteed us wet feet, especially if we weren't wearing the wellies, or the Russian boots as they were called back then. If you were in short trousers, however, which most of us were, these boots would cut the legs off you just behind your calves. To ease the pain, you had to fold the boots down to stop them rubbing on your bare skin. This made them shorter. So you had to remember your welly boot height as you walked in the gushing river water. Otherwise, disaster would strike. Not only would you have wet feet, but you would stink of stagnant water as well. Santry Woods was a huge expanse to us. It was always dark because of the dense tree cover there, especially during the summertime. It was really and truly a wilderness, exactly what budding Tom Sawyers and Daniel Boones like ourselves wanted. We were told stories of Lady Margaret Domville, the wife of Sir Charles, sailing around the lake between the islands on a steam-driven pleasure boat, which fired our imaginations no end. The mansion that once stood there was Santry Court. It had a tree-lined walk which led down to the lake. With the mansion long gone, the estate went into dereliction, and in our time, the lake had long become a swamp, and the two islands previously surrounded by the water had long since just become part of this stinking, stagnant swamp. Upstream from this swamp, there was the old stone bridge. We used to get under it to scream as loud as we could, because there was a great echo there. On this particular visit, however, we didn't venture up that far. We had other things on our mind. This particular summer, with the help of a lot of rain-bearing thunderstorms, the water levels rose significantly, and the islands magically became islands again. We spotted this when we were coming home from Larkhill School on the bus. This presented us with the challenge of building a raft that would actually float and bring us to the lost islands of Santry Woods. What we were going to do when we got there wasn't really the point. We just had to get there, and get there by raft. I was about 10 or 11 at the time, and it was the usual turnip and crew of Noel Murphy, Johnny Darcy, Noel Cooley and myself. Derek and Jerry Madden were drafted in with us because of all their sailing and rafting building skills that they would have got down beside McGurk's River, which was in front of their house around on the back road. Derek Madden was good at putting things together. Once he cut a big council tar barrel right down the middle using a hacksaw, took him a week to do it, and we tried to float it in McGurk's River, but it sank within 30 seconds of going into the water. The many ghosts of past floating failures were going to be laid to rest on this expedition. After watching an episode on television of Tom Sawyer, where Tom had used some small barrels as floats under a raft, I had decided that a few small oil drums were the answer for us. There were lots of them to be found in our big shed in our yard in number 21. This shed was where Uncle Joseph, the mechanic of the family, did most of his work. Engine oil was always being replaced, so there was always a few empty 5-gallon Castrol oil drums knocking around. It was behind this shed that myself and the brother Noel were one day busily detonating some of my father's rifle bullets, just to hear the bang and the ricochets. My mother heard the shots ringing out and ran down to stop us as we were placing the bullets on a concrete block. We weren't totally stupid, however. We were up on the shed roof, out of the line of fire, and dropping the blocks down from a height. We wouldn't come down until Ma promised not to tell Da, and then promised not to beat the daylights out of us. We won that battle, but we didn't win the war. Noel and I had a look around the big shed and pulled out the 4 drums that were required for the raft. There was a 4-pram trolley lying around from the previous year's stock car craze, so we just put the drums into that. It was painted a bright red, and it had a big number 6 painted on the back, and it was just about big enough for the 4 drums to fit snug and tight for the journey to the woods. One of the drums, however, was nearly full with engine oil, so we just brought it around to the back of the shed and dumped the oil out onto the ground. We were in a hurry, and the oil seemed to flow forever. It glopped and glopped slowly, as it poured out through the extended plastic nozzle. To this day, when I top my car up with oil, that glopping noise as it flows into the engine brings me right back to this incident. I'm not sure whose idea the emptying out of the oil drum was, but it was a bad one. Even when I was watching the oil spread out and soak into the coal and slack covered mud, I knew it was wrong. It was nearly a full 5 gallon drum of unused engine oil, and it certainly took the good out of the day for us, because both of us got into big trouble over it when we surfaced later on that evening, tired and weary from our day's adventures in Santry Woods. Dad and Joseph were not impressed, but when Grandad Cooley found out about it the next day, he was really disgusted with us. Both me and Noel took our punishment quietly, and when the stinging in our legs had finally died down, we were made cover the oil patch over with dry filling, which thankfully soaked most of it up. I remember asking Grandad how much the oil cost, as I was thinking about paying for it. It didn't help at all, because Grandad didn't really care about the money. I think he was just disgusted that we had emptied it out deliberately onto the ground and wasted it. We had let him down, and I was really embarrassed that we had done it. Back with the expedition, on our reconnaissance mission to the woods a few days previous, we had noticed that there was already a few pallets floating around in the water. Abandoned relics of previous failed attempts to get a raft out onto the water. We decided that we would use the best and the biggest of these rafts, so we only had to get the oil drums there with some twine to lash them to the wood. Noel Murphy had a brainwave involving nails, which would be driven through the wood into the barrels below to help to fix them in place. It seemed like a good idea at the time, so we went with it instead of using the twine. Armed with a hammer, 6-inch nails, and our trusty bright red number 6 trolley carrying the 4 drums, the raft gang headed off to Santry Woods. Someone had a penknife, and we always brought matches, as campfires were seldom needed but always lit anyway. Fires out in the jungle were always exciting. We had to go by road because of the trolley. Up we went past the bus corner, we crossed over to Casey's, and while we ran, with myself pulling the trolley and nobody holding the 4 drums in place, I hit the curb and they all scattered and rolled out onto the main road. What a din there was. The horns of the speeding cars blared as we tried to retrieve the rolling drums from the path of oncoming cars and trucks. Everybody in our little group was blaming each other. We regrouped at Casey's, with a little blonde Joseph Casey looking on over the small front wall, bemused by the whole noisy carry-on. His mother, Fan Casey, came out and waved a disapproving cigarette in our direction as she gathered him up and took him inside. I spotted Lizzie Hines, who had just got off the bus, standing watching the whole thing. It wouldn't be long before our carry-on at the bus corner would be all over the terrace. Telephone, telegram, tell Lizzie. We decided to get going again, and with the brother Noel now holding the drums in place, I pulled the trolley along past the little cottage where the McDonald sisters live, and they were always pottering around in that garden. On we passed by the entrance to Furry Park Pitch and Putt. One of the Murphy men were there, either Andrew or Sean. They let a few roars at us in fun, but we bolted, our nerves still on edge from the scattered drums incident a few minutes previously, and we charged up to Roland Caravan to hide and catch our breath. We were now standing on the brow of the Barrack Hill. The brother Noel spotted the speeding trolley opportunity at the same time as I did. The Barrack Hill was a good 100-foot run of steep hill that ran past Lambert's Gate at Claremont and right up to the red gate of Jack Roberts' old cottage. I jumped first. Bagsy's first down the hill, I shouted, already getting into the trolley, which was quickly relieved of its 4-drum cargo. The trolley wasn't great. The wheels were buckled from previous crashes and the rope-controlled steering was a bit wonky. Speeding down on a pathway only 1 foot from speeding oncoming motor traffic was a bit unnerving, but we all got a few turns and we all survived. After the speeding trolley stuff had passed, the expedition duly marched on with the 4 GTX oil drums now back on board. The trolley spin on the Barrack Hill was a small distraction, but the prospect of floating on a raft was getting us all excited. Oh yes, the Holy Grail awaited us. Everybody except Johnny Darcy came in through Roberts's gate, crossing the river, which flowed past, on out under the road. Jack Roberts had long since moved to number 3 Turnipin Lane, and there was nobody there to stop us. We cut in through the big red and white gate, walking around the long way behind the cottage. There was a beautiful smell of roses, which seemed to be everywhere. It was a lot quieter now, because of the ivy-covered wall of the road bridge, and the fact we were now down in a hollow. Once around the cottage, we cut back upwards towards the bridge arch that led back under the main road. I was given the task of pulling the trolley along the rough, muddy terrain. My brother Noel helped me pull the trolley along as we stumbled from rock to rock in the river trying to get it over. Unfortunately, he got his feet wet for his efforts. The river crossing had been a bit of a struggle with the trolley, so we duly abandoned it midstream and watched it spin away in the strong water flow. It was sad to see our faithful number 6 disappear under the bridge arch, but I reckoned it would just jam the other side up towards Monk's Bridge, so we could recover it another day. As I mentioned already, Johnny Darcy had taken the scenic route, doing a Tarzan call, as he held to his two giant cupped hands, as per the actor Ron Eloy from the television series Tarzan. We looked up to see Johnny swinging down from a height, holding on to the support bars of the White Hilton Hotel double-sided signs, which were fixed to the ground at the wall beside the river bridge. Johnny was skinny, but very wiry, and he was generally up for anything. With each of us now carrying a drum, we all started running excitedly toward the lake's edge. Poor Noel's feet were wet already, so he was now quickly down to his bare feet. First things first, we needed to get the big pallet that was floating out in the water. That was our first challenge. The pallet was floating about 15 feet out in the water, and it was lying close to a large half-submerged tree branch. If you've ever seen the Everglades, where people in small boats are weaving in and out under big rooted trees, all dark and misty, then you're getting what it was like. The place was full of bird song and the flapping of nervous wings as we disturbed the quiet upon our arrival. Noel, being barefoot already, was nominated to wade out and try and get at the pallet. He was nervous. He'd every right to be. As soon as he got out about 5 feet along the tree trunk lying sideways in the water, there was a big splash as someone had threw a big stone close to him. As the water hit him, he stood up. The tree trunk spun and in went Noel. He was shouting and I was immediately running into the water. Jesus, it was cold and stinking. As I trudged towards Noel, he got his balance and he stood up in about 2 feet of water. He was effing and blinding at whoever had thrown the stone. But before long, with the danger past, everybody was laughing, including him. Still standing in the water, we assessed the situation. We were wet anyway, so Noel and me continued on out. Back up onto the tree trunks, we moved along passing branches and floating logs, trying to grab that elusive pallet. With two of us out on the water, that left 4 at the water's edge. We could hear shouting in the distance, and suddenly it was getting closer. We weren't the only ones in the woods. As the group came closer, we saw that it was a bunch of younger kids from Santry Village. I recognised the two young Hanleys, Oliver and Vincent, with Jerry McCabe and a blonde-haired Terry Clark, who were all running with a dog, who in the excitement came into the water towards me and Noel. Once it hit the water, the dog retreated quickly, and the poor thing was covered in a foul-smelling mud. With the dog out, they scampered quickly, shouting a few choice words in our direction as they parted. They were probably more afraid of us turnipin heads than we were of them. If, however, there had been a few more older ones with them, we were in trouble, as they regarded Santry Woods as their territory. But thankfully, this time, they had retreated. Back in the water, we managed to get a hold of the pallet, and we pushed it back towards the others. I wasn't impressed with the rock incident, and I suddenly thought of Ma's reaction when we would get home. We were soaked to the skin already. We were going to get it. We pulled the pallet out of the water, and we slipped the 4 oil drums underneath, one in each corner. Noel Murphy stepped in with the hammer and nails and did what he had to do. He hammered at least two into the pallet, which pierced into the drums. They seemed sturdy enough, but as we lifted the raft, turning it over as we did, the drums just slid off the nails, hit the ground, and rolled towards the water's edge. Some of us were laughing. Then Derek Madden suggested we reposition the drums back onto the nails and then tie them in place with the rope and twine. Good thinking on Derek's behalf. Within minutes, we were on the verge of launching the craft that would make us sailors and seafarers, and the excitement was building. Although it was summertime and quite warm, the cold water and thick shade kept us freezing. Cold, wet clothes didn't help, so Noel and myself decided to take off our wet, smelly t-shirts. We dragged the raft over to the edge and we pushed it in, and yes, it was floating. Johnny Darcy jumped on first, getting his balance really quickly, and he was away. We were jumping and cheering as Johnny moved himself along using a big stick that he had found on the bank. Within a couple of minutes, he had reached the island and he was still dry. He got off, did his Tarzan cry again, and then he jumped back on and started back towards us. I noticed that we had positioned the open nozzles of the two drums under the waterline, so in fact, the raft was already sinking. Johnny was blissfully unaware, but within 20 seconds, the raft was lopsided and capsizing. Johnny was making a meal of it. Then splash, in he went as well. I was happy now that at least me and Noel weren't the only ones wet. We pulled out the raft, reset the drums, but Noel Murphy's nail holes were now the problem. We plugged them with twigs, but the small nail holes were still not completely watertight. As we relaunched again, we knew we were in a race against time. All of us, with the exception of Jerry Madden, ended up in the water. This was important, since he had the matches because he smoked. We didn't care, because we had finally built a raft that would float. With all of us on the island, we decided to go native in the jungle. We gathered up wood and dry grass, and within minutes we had a fire going. It was now time to start drying our stinking wet clothes beside a stinking smoking fire. When the smoke cleared and the firewood was roaring red, it was lovely and warm to our front, but freezing at our backs. Red-faced and toasting, we positioned our clothes on standing sticks close to the fire and waited. Now, if we had stopped to think about it, there wasn't really any point in trying to dry the clothes, because we were on the island, with a sunken raft, so there was no way back except wading through the water again. With darkness falling, the glowing fire looked really cosy, as it burned brightly, giving off a few bursts of sparks if we disturbed it by throwing on more wood. Noel Murphy had broken a few bulrushes and set them on fire, and as they burned, they cast shadows in all directions, including our faces, which made them a little grotesque and creepy in the half-light. Santry Woods was a spooky place. I had heard the story of the sodden path from my father. This story had been passed down from my granduncle Tom Kavanagh, who once lived on Bullock Hill in Santry Woods. An old soldier. On this path after nightfall, you would travel around in circles on this sodden path until next daybreak. I figured we were in enough trouble already, so I called an end to the day's adventure. We poured water on the fire, and it was really cold immediately. So cold, in fact, that I was actually shivering and doing that with my teeth on my lips. Our feet were freezing as well as we squeezed them into the cold, wet rubber boots. We gathered up all our stuff and held what we could shoulder high to avoid the water as we waded out from the island. The limping raft had hid itself beside a few half-submerged tree trunks, as if it was sulking and ashamed that it had let us down for the crucial home crossing. We cut under the main road bridge and headed home through Geraghty's fields, starving and stinking of stagnant water and smoke. As I expected, I saw the number 6 trolley jammed in the distance at Monks's Bridge. There would have to be another time for trolley salvage work. By the time we hit Dunn's Corner, the word was out that we were in trouble for all sorts of things. Spilling oil, nearly causing accidents, smoking in the woods, running around with no clothes on, the list was growing, but we didn't care. We were sailors now, and had floated on water, and had conquered and found the lost islands of Santry Woods.
I've only this to say to you, oh, why?
You've just been listening to myself, Jerry Cooley, narrating one of my stories, Santry Woods, Rafts and Bulrushes. This is the fourth story in our series of six. Next week, I'll be reading another one. I hope you'll join me.
Was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.